This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Survivors, a novel of the coming collapse by James Wesley Rawls, performed by Dick Hill. Author's introductory note. Unlike most novel sequels, the storyline of Survivors is contemporaneous with the events described in my previously published novel, Patriots. Thus, there is no need to read it first, or subsequently, but you'll likely find it entertaining. Deo Volente, another contemporaneous novel in this series, will be published next year. Check my blog, www.survivalblog.com, for updates. Disclaimers. All rights reserved. Any unauthorized duplication in whole or in part, or dissemination of this edition by any means, including but not limited to photocopying, electronic bulletin boards, and the Internet, will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. This is a work of fiction. All of the events described are imaginary. Most of the characters in this novel are fictional. A few real-life individuals gave permission for their names to be mentioned. Aside from these individuals, any resemblance to living people is purely coincidental. The making and or possession of some of the devices and mixtures described in this novel are possibly illegal in some jurisdictions. Even the mere possession of the uncombined components might be construed as criminal intent. Consult your state and local laws. If you make any of these devices and or formulations, you accept sole responsibility for their possession and use. You are also responsible for your own stupidity and or carelessness. This information is intended for education purposes only, to add realism to a work of fiction. This novel does not constitute legal advice. Consult a juror society or lawyer if you have legal questions. The medical details contained within this novel do not constitute medical advice. Consult a doctor or herbalist if you have medical questions. The purpose of this novel is to entertain and to educate. The author and Atria Books, Simon & Schuster, shall have neither liability nor responsibility to any citizen, person, or entity with respect to any loss or damage caused or alleged to be caused directly or indirectly by the information contained in this novel. Chapter 1. Urgency and Exigency. Weapons compound man's power to achieve. They amplify the capabilities of both the good man and the bad, and to exactly the same degree, having no will of their own. Thus, we must regard them as servants, not masters, and good servants to good men. Without them, man is diminished, and his opportunities to fulfill his destiny are lessened. An unarmed man can only flee from evil, and evil is not overcome by fleeing from it. Colonel Jeff Cooper. FOB Wolverine, Task Force Duke, Zabul Province, Afghanistan. October, the first year. Andy was awoken by the sound of mortars. His many months in Afghanistan had taught him the difference in sound between outgoing and incoming mortars and various artillery. These were distant mortars, so he knew that it wasn't friendly fire. Andy already had Operation Enduring Freedom camouflage pattern, OCP pants, and interceptor body armor, IBA, on, and was snatching up his M4 carbine and helmet when the take shelter warning siren sounded. He popped out the door of his containerized housing unit, Chew, and jumped down into the entrance of the heavily sandbagged shelter just a few steps away. Moments later, the two lieutenants from the Chew next door piled in behind him. One of them took the precaution of scanning the floor and walls of the shelter for scorpions with a flashlight. He found just one and stomped it without comment. The mortar rounds started to come in, with a succession of sharp blasts that shook the ground. There were about 20 impacts, arriving in a span of 10 seconds. They could see the flashes of the explosions reflected on the wall opposite the doorway. The closest round impacted about 100 feet away, close enough that shock waves could be felt. As the rounds came in, Andy Lane said a silent prayer. He knew that only a direct hit would endanger him, but it was still unnerving since he had less than a month left in country.
"That may be all she wrote, sir," said one of the lieutenants dryly.
Lane agreed.
"You're probably right. Just another shooting scoot deal."
At the far side of the forward operating base, FOB, they could hear the echoed commands from the Arty boys and then the deep-throated crumps of outgoing mortars. They sounded like big, 4.2-inch mortars, just 3 rounds. Andy marveled at how quickly the counter-battery radar team could pinpoint the insurgents' firing location and direct return fire. Less than a minute after the enemy rounds impacted, the reply was sent, no doubt with considerable precision. It was no wonder that the mortar duels with the jihadis had become less frequent in recent months. As they waited for the all-clear horn, Andy leaned against the sandbag wall and stretched his calf muscles, more out of habit than because of any stiffness. At 6 feet 2 inches, with a runner's physique, he weighed just 180 pounds and prided himself on his flexibility. When doing PT with his units in garrison, he was always among the most limber. The next morning, along with dozens of his fellow Fobbits, Lane did a bit of gawking at the damage done by the mortars. It actually wasn't much. One round had shredded the corner of a chew, and another perforated a tent with dozens of small holes, the largest about 3 inches across. All the rest of the mortar impacts had no effect, leaving only black marks on the ground and some scattered shrapnel. A couple of the newbies to the FOB posed for pictures in front of the damaged chew.
"So what? Big deal," Andy muttered to himself as he walked to the company headquarters.
At 31 years old, Anders Lane was the typical lean and fit U.S. Army captain. He was on his second deployment to Afghanistan. His first had been to Iraq. On this new deployment, his assignment was branch immaterial. Although he was branched Ordnance Corps, he was assigned as a staff officer in a striker battalion, an infantry unit equipped with 16-ton wheeled armored personnel carriers, APCs. With the heavy manpower requirements of ongoing deployments to Afghanistan, it was not unusual for officers to get assignments outside of their usual career path. The needs of the Army was the reason often cited when making these assignments. Andy and his older brother Lars had grown up in the shadow of their late father, Robbie Lane, a Finnish-born Army officer who retired as a full colonel. Their father earned his U.S. citizenship by joining the U.S. Army, and eventually retired to a small horse ranch near Bloomfield, New Mexico. Robbie had been raised on a farm and was convinced that he should retire on a farm. Their late mother was an American of mostly Swedish ancestry. She had died of breast cancer when the boys were in high school. Following the mortar barrage, Andy spent a frustrating 10-hour day of pushing paper for the battalion, which was greatly complicated by the process of the unit's upcoming redeployment to Germany. That afternoon, Andy chatted with Larry Ekenis, the battalion S1, the staff officer in charge of personnel. Ekenis had been Lane's martial arts sparring partner for the past several months. He had taught Andy some Hwarang Do katas, and Andy reciprocated, teaching Larry his mixed martial arts moves. Their battalion, or squadron in striker parlance, was a forward-deployed part of the 2nd Striker Cavalry Regiment, headquartered in Wilseck, Germany. The incoming squadron was a sister unit in the same regiment and also part of Task Force Duke, but Andy's squadron was headed back to Germany in a regularly scheduled unit rotation. Lane and Ekinus had been discussing events back home. Lately, the war effort had been taking a back seat to tumultuous economic events emanating from New York City and the world's other financial centers. Larry Ekinus seemed worried but was trying to be upbeat. He asked,
"You think that this'll blow over, right?"
Lane put on a glum face. "At this point, there's no way. The whole system is breaking down. The global credit market is frozen. The sovereign debt problems have blown up past the GDP levels for most countries, and the derivatives have totally imploded. We're in a world of hurt. I think there'll be some major riots and looting soon."
Ekinus bit his lip.
"Well, that won't be a big deal for my family. Most of them live in eastern Oregon. Have you ever been through Ontario, Oregon? It's out in the middle of nowhere. The disruption will be in the big cities. Our town is 300 miles from Portland and more than 350 from Seattle as the crow flies."
Lane shook his head. "I wish it was that simple. Sure, the riots will be in the big cities. The metro areas will be death traps. The suburbs will be only marginally safer. But you gotta realize that these days, even the small towns are dependent on long chains of supply. When the 18-wheelers stop rolling, everyone is going to be hurting.
It will definitely be safer out in the boonies, but you should tell your family to stock up on every scrap of food they can find. They need to get out of dollars and into canned goods right away."
"You really think it'll get that bad?"
Lane answered soberly.
"I'm afraid it will. Does your family live in town or out on a ranch?"
"Used to be ranchers. All in town now, but we're Basques, so we still know how to live the old-fashioned way. My mom used to cook a lot of our meals in a Dutch oven. I didn't even know how fast food tasted until I went off to college. There's no comparison to my mom's cooking."
"Well, with those skills, and living where they do, they'll probably ride the storm out pretty safely."
The conversation left Andy feeling uneasy about his plans for leaving active duty. Strapping on his Molly vest to leave his desk at the battalion headquarters, Andy turned to Ekinus to say,
"Well, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. I'm going to stop by my chew and grab a duffel bag, and then I'm off to the Haji Mart."
It was 90 degrees, but felt even hotter since Andy was wearing IBA and had the weight of an M4 carbine slung across his back, a PRC-148 radio, and numerous Molly magazine pouches. The only concession to being in a relatively safe area was that he was wearing a boonie hat instead of a Mitch helmet. As Captain Lane walked past the guards manning the HESCO barriers at the FOB's main gate, he read the signs on the Haji Market windows just across the road. They proclaimed "Very Best Prices, DVD, and Custom Tailorer," imaginatively spelled. As he walked in the door, the smell of the market hit Andy like a hammer. It was an odd mix of Turkish tobacco smoke, incense, kerosene, sweat, and overcooked lamb. It certainly didn't smell like the exchange store back at the FOB. Aside from the hint of JP-8 jet fuel, which was a presence everywhere in the FOB, the exchange smelled just like any retail store in America. Hardly any smell at all, almost antiseptic. In contrast, Ali's store reeked. An aging Italian-made air conditioner was roaring above the door, but not keeping up. It was perhaps 10 degrees cooler inside than outside. Nabil Jassim Ali gave his usual "Salam, salam, Mr. Colonel" greeting. The portly and balding Pashtuni flashed his yellowed, crooked teeth. He called all the American soldiers Colonel, even the privates. It still made Andy laugh every time he heard it. Eyeing the empty duffel bag slung over Lane's shoulder, Ali chortled,
"Perhaps you are wanting to buy plentiful numbers of thingings, Mr. Colonel."
Lane nodded.
Ali waved him in and added, "The store? I am closing in a few minutes, but for you, Colonel, I am willing to be late."
You always have the best deals, Mr. Ali, Andy said with a smile.
Do you have Afghanis?
The American dollar not so good today. It is slipping off another 5%.
Down 5% in 1 week? Andy asked.
In 1 day, Colonel,
Ali replied seriously.
Soon, I think. I take no more America money.
Don't worry, sir. I have plenty of Afghanis. His front pocket indeed bulged with a huge wad of cash, a mix of Afghanis, dollars, and a few euros. In the bottom of his pocket, he also felt the weight of 18 American Eagle 1 ounce silver coins in plastic sleeves. Ali's store had the usual Haji-marked merchandise. There were cigarettes, pirated CDs and DVDs, imitation designer sunglasses, magazines, mostly in Arabic, cheap Chinese knives and ersatz Leatherman tools, candy, sunflower seeds, sodas and sports drinks, jerky, chewing gum, and assorted trinkets. There were three young striker troops already in the store when Captain Lane arrived. When he passed them in the dimly lit narrow aisles, they each acknowledged him with a hushed, "High speed, sir." That was the newly arrived battalion's unofficial motto. But Andy was accustomed to hearing it at a much higher volume inside the FOB. Lane sorted through packets of jerky, settling mostly on the teriyaki flavor, piling up a large stack in the crook of his left arm. The three enlisted soldiers completed their purchases, buying the usual Fobbit food, energy bars, packets of salty chips, and Coca-Colas that came in cans with both English and Arabic markings. After the three soldiers left the store, Lane stacked the packets of jerky on the counter. Then he walked back to the shelf to get a second armload. This, too, he stacked on the counter. Ali smiled.
"Perhaps you are wanting to buy all of my jerky?" he asked.
Lane chuckled and replied, "Well, not all of it, just most of it." Next he went to stock up on batteries. He ignored the Egyptian bargain brand, of dubious quality, and selected a dozen four-packs of Energizer AA batteries, being careful to pick the ones with the latest expiration dates. While Lane was sorting battery packages, Ali locked the front door and turned the open sign around. Lane stacked the batteries in a couple of piles next to the jerky on the counter. Then his gaze shifted to Ali's permanent smile. After a pause, Lane asked, "I've heard that you sell some other, unusual merchandise that you keep in back." He pointed to the doorway to the back room, which, among other things, served as a kitchen and bedroom.
"Sir, I have non-alcohol. It is forbidden."
No, that is not what I meant. I've heard that you had some more expensive merchandise, like watches, some good optics, and guns.
Ali's smile got bigger than usual, and he nodded.
"One moment, Mr. Colonel," he said, then disappeared into the back room.
Ali returned, lugging a large suitcase, and Lane knew that he had struck pay dirt. This was where the rumor mill at the FOB said the shopkeeper reputedly kept the good stuff. Ali gently slid the heavy suitcase onto the store counter, unfastened the latches, and spun it around. He opened it to display a large assortment of new and used wristwatches, digital cameras, film cameras, binoculars, assorted boxes of ammunition, and a few pistol holsters. Lane and Ali spent the next 5 minutes haggling over the price of a pair of rubber-armored Nikon 7x30 compact binoculars. They finally settled on a figure that seemed high to Andy, but he assented, realizing the prices would surely be double that in less than a month, perhaps in just a few days. Lane paid for the jerky, batteries, and binoculars, nearly depleting his wad of Afghanis. Eyeing the boxes of ammo, he said, "I see you have some 9mm ammunition here. You have any pistols in that caliber?
Ali frowned.
Oh, yes, Colonel, I do, but you cannot be afford them. Prices are, what is it they say, escalating. For a pistol, a good one? We are conversing of $5,000 American.
What if I paid you in silver? Lujain coins. Lujain?
Ah, Lujain.
This works for me. In Kabul, silver closed today at 83 American dollars for 1 ounce. In London, it was $81.
Andy nodded. The man certainly knew his markets.
Mr. Ali turned and again walked to the back room. Lane heard the sounds of boxes being shifted and restacked. Soon the store owner returned with another suitcase that looked even older than the first. He put it on the counter, flipped the latches, and swung it open. Captain Lane let out a slight gasp when he saw the contents. The suitcase was crammed full of pistols, revolvers, holsters, and magazines. Andy sorted through the guns. He saw older Afghan Army-issued Tokarevs, a few ancient revolvers that look either Belgian or German, and a couple of Egyptian Helwan pistols. One revolver immediately seemed suspect. It was a Pakistani copy of a Webley 38 revolver. Looking closely at the gun, he saw that it was peppered with fake proof mark stampings and was erroneously stamped Welby. That made Andy laugh. Seeing Andy's expression, the storekeeper noted,
"Oh, the guns from Peshawar, they are not so good."
Andy replied, "Now that's an understatement." He didn't trust their metallurgy and mechanical tolerances any more than he did their spelling. Putting the revolver down, Andy noticed that there were several plastic Glock Model 19 magazines, but no Glock pistols. "You have any Glocks?"
"Oh, sorry, Mr. Colonel, but none of those I have. Those guns of Glock sell very quick when I'm getting one."
Then Andy spotted a pistol in a well-made holster that looked different from the others. Withdrawing it from the holster, Andy was pleased to see a SIG P-228 9mm pistol in nearly new condition. It looked just like the U.S. Army-issue P-228s that the CID agents carried, except that it wasn't stamped U.S. property.
"Ah, this is my most nice of my pistols. You are liking it?"
The moment that he saw the SIG, Andy knew that he was going to buy it. The moment felt portentous somehow. He nodded and said,
"Yes, I do like it."
He knew that it was against regulations to bring any weapon home from the OEF theater of operations. Andy rummaged through the suitcase and found six spare SIG P226 series magazines, including two 13-rounders, three 15-rounders, and just one scarce magazine of 20-round capacity. He took a few minutes to closely inspect both the gun and the magazines. The pistol had no rust pitting and just a bit of finish wear at the muzzle. Locking back the slide, he examined the bore, holding a slip of paper behind the barrel to act as a reflector. Cupping his hand over the rear sight and holding the back end of the pistol nearly to his face, he could see the faint glow of tritium dots. He muttered to himself,
11.2-year half-life.
The magazines were genuine Sig Sauer made, with the distinctive zigzag seam on the back, and they, too, looked nearly new. Setting the holstered pistol and the four magazines next to his previous purchases, he said,
"This will do." "Ah, I will sell you the Sig with just of only one magazine for 30 ounces of silver and 1 ounce more for each magazine more."
Lane shook his head and answered,
No. That is too much.
My offer is 8 ounces, and I want you to include these magazines.
This is an insult to my family. Shall my children starve and beg in the street? I am not a fool. But, for you, as good and honorable officer, I will make a price of 20 ounces, with those extra magazines including.
No, make it 12. Ali shook his head. 18 ounces. And he countered. Nope. 15.
16,
Ali snapped back. Andy replied firmly, done. They shook hands. Andy counted out 16 of the American Eagles, all still packaged in 2-coin flip plastic sleeves. Ali took the time to scrutinize the pairs of coins closely, removing several of them from their sleeves. He looked satisfied.
You are needing of ammunitions?
No, thanks. I've got plenty. 9 mil is standard for the Army. Andy spent a few more minutes rummaging through the suitcases, selecting a pair of magazine pouches that had obviously been made for different double-column pistol magazines, but fit the standard SIG magazines. A tight fit, but they would do. Each pouch held a pair of magazines. The two pouches cost $220 in the increasingly worthless greenbacks. Starting with the holstered pistol at the bottom, Andy filled the duffel bag with his purchases and again shook hands with Ali. It was nearing sunset, and the temperature outside was down to 80 degrees. Ali unbarred the door, and they exchanged salamu alaikum, go in peace, goodbyes. Andy wondered how peaceful things would be in the near future. Not very, he muttered to himself as he shouldered the duffel bag. Chapter 2. Stocking Up. What people did not realize was that war had started. By 1 p.m., a few minutes after Molotov's speech, queues, especially in the food stores, began to grow. The women shoppers in the gastronomes or grocery stores started to buy indiscriminately canned goods, which Russians do not like very much, butter, sugar, lard, flour, groat, sausage, matches, salt. In 20 years of Soviet power, Leningraders had learned by bitter experience what to expect in time of crisis. They rushed to the stores to buy what they could. They gave preference to foods which would keep. But they were not particular. One shopper bought 5 kilos of caviar. Another, 10. At the savings banks, the people clutched worn and greasy passbooks in their hands. They were drawing out every ruble that stood to their accounts. Many headed straight for the commission shops. There they turned over fat packets of paper money for diamond rings, gold watches, emerald earrings, oriental rugs, brass samovars. The crowds outside the savings banks quickly became disorderly. No one wanted to wait. They demanded their money sekhraz immediately. Police detachments appeared. By 3 p.m., the banks had closed, having exhausted their supply of currency. They did not reopen again until Tuesday. Monday was their closed day. When they opened again, the government had imposed a limit on withdrawals of 200 rubles per person per month. Harrison E. Salisbury, The 900 Days, The Siege of Leningrad, 1969. Farmington, New Mexico, October, the first year. At that same time that Andy Lane was at the Haji Mart in Afghanistan, his brother Lars was 11,500 miles away, rolling a cart into a Sam's Club store in Farmington, New Mexico. It was 6:52 a.m. in New Mexico and 5:22 p.m. in Zabul Province, Afghanistan. Both men had the same thing on their minds, stocking up in quantity and immediately. The Lane brothers shared a sense of urgency, realizing that there would likely be very few opportunities to stock up on things before mass currency inflation
destroyed the value of their savings. The news outlets made it clear that things were falling apart quickly. Very quickly. The Sam's Club store in Farmington, New Mexico, was about to open for the day. There was a large crowd of perhaps 100 anxious shoppers, many waiting with their membership cards in hand, standing behind oversized shopping carts and flat cargo carts. Lars Lane eyed his wife, Lisbeth, who was seated on their cart next to their 6-year-old daughter, Grace. Beth was 34, with curly brown hair and hazel eyes. She was slightly overweight and had struggled all through their marriage to maintain her figure. As Grace was doodling in her coloring book, Beth was adding items to an already long shopping list. She stood up, leaned close to Lars, and spoke directly at the hearing aid in his good ear.
"We'd better hit the canned food section first, hon," she suggested.
He nodded and answered, "Roger that." Beth smiled, gave him a peck on the cheek, and again sat on the cart to wait. Lars glanced around, sizing up the crowd. The middle-aged woman standing next to him was staring at his left hand. Lars hated that. It was hurtful to him that people stared so much at the flesh-colored rubber prosthetic. They always seemed transfixed, as if the hand were some alien creature that had just landed on Earth. They stared at his left hand, or at the left side of his face, or alternated between staring at both, and it made him feel like a circus freak. The reconstructive surgery on his left cheekbone, which had used a piece of one of his ribs, was less than perfect. Sometimes people he hadn't met before, or who hadn't seen him in many years, would approach him from the right side, smiling, and then he'd turn his head toward them and they'd suddenly look repulsed. The Quasimodo effect is what Lars called it. 1 month earlier, on a street corner in Durango, Colorado, the nearest city with large department stores where Lars was shopping for a new refrigerator, a man who appeared to be in his 70s walked up to Lars and asked simply, "Iraq?" Lars answered, "Afghanistan, sir. I was in that little Dominican thing, and then I did a tour in Vietnam. I came back without a scratch." The old man looked Lars in the eye and said firmly, "Thanks for your service, and for what it cost you. Welcome home." He shook his hand and strode away. Lane's eyes welled up a bit, but he didn't cry. That one encounter made up for a whole lot of previous Quasimodo moments. Finally, the roll-up door opened and the crowd rushed in. Lars and Beth headed for the canned food section and started stacking full cases on the cart. That was just the first cartload. They stacked the cart high on 3 successive trips into the store that morning. The television news anchors had recently started calling the intensifying economic crisis the crunch. The term soon stuck with the general public, becoming part of the general lexicon. Government spending was out of control. The credit market was in continuous turmoil. Meanwhile, bank runs and huge federal bailouts had become commonplace. The debt and budget deficit had spiraled to stratospheric numbers. A Congressional Budget Office report stated that to pay just the interest on the national debt for the year, it would take 100% of the year's individual income tax revenue, 100% of corporate and excise taxes, and 41% of Social Security payroll taxes. As the crunch began, interest on the national debt was consuming 96% of government revenue. The official national debt was over $6 trillion. The unofficial debt, which included out-year unfunded obligations such as entitlements, long-term bonds, and military pensions, topped $53 trillion. The debt accumulated at the rate of $9 billion a day, or $15,000 per second. The official national debt had ballooned to 120% of the gross domestic product and was compounding at the rate of 18% per year. The federal government was borrowing 193% of revenue for the year. The president was nearing the end of his term in office. The stagnant economy, rising interest rates, and creeping inflation troubled him. Publicly, he beamed about having beat the deficit. Privately, he admitted that the low deficit figures came from moving increasingly large portions of federal funding off budget. Behind the accounting smoke and mirrors game, the real deficit was growing. Government spending at all levels equated to 45% of the gross domestic product. In July, the recently appointed chairman of the Federal Reserve Board had a private meeting with the president. The chairman pointed out the fact that even if Congress could balance the budget, the national debt would still grow inexorably due to compounding interest. In Europe, international bankers began to vocally express their doubts that the U.S. government could continue to make its interest payments on the burgeoning debt. In mid-August, the chairman of the Deutsche Bundesbank made some off-the-record comments to a reporter from The Economist magazine. Within hours, his words flashed around the world via the Internet. "A full-scale default on U.S. treasuries appears imminent." His choice of the word, imminent, in the same sentence with the word default, caused the value of the dollar to plummet on the international currency exchanges the next day. T-bill sales crashed simultaneously. Starting with the Japanese, foreign central banks and international monetary authorities began to dump their trillions of dollars in U.S. treasuries. None of them wanted the now risky T-bills or U.S. bonds. Within days, long-term U.S. Treasury paper was selling at 20 cents on the dollar. Foreign investors began liquidating their U.S. paper assets, stocks, bonds, T-bills, virtually anything denominated in U.S. dollars. After some weak attempts to prop up the dollar, most of the European Union nations and Japan announced that they would no longer employ the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. The Federal Reserve began monetizing larger and larger portions of the debt. The Fed already owned $682 billion in Treasury debt, which was considered an asset for the purposes of expanding the money supply. In just a few days, Federal Reserve holdings in Treasury debt more than doubled. The presses were running around the clock printing currency. Soon after, the domestic inflation rate jumped to 16% in the third week of August. To the dismay of the Fed, the economy refused to bounce back. The balance of trade figures grew steadily worse. Leading economic indicators declined to a standstill. Legislators in Washington, D.C. belatedly wanted to slash federal spending, but were frustrated that they couldn't touch most of it. The majority of the budget consisted of interest payments and various entitlement programs. Previous legislation had locked in these payments. Even worse, by law, many of these spending programs even had automatic inflation escalators. So the federal budget continued to expand, primarily because of the interest burden on the federal debt. The interest payments grew tremendously as rates started to soar. It soon took 85% interest rates to lure investors to six-month T-bills. The Treasury Department stopped auctioning longer-term paper entirely in late August. With inflation roaring, nobody wanted to lend Uncle Sam money for the long term. Jittery American investors increasingly distrusted the government, the stock market, and even the dollar itself. In September, new factory orders and new housing starts dropped off to levels that could not be properly measured. Corporations, large and small, began massive layoffs. The unemployment rate jumped from 12% to 20% in less than a month. Then came the stock market crash in early October. The bull stock market had gone on years longer than expected, defying the traditional business cycle. Nearly everyone thought that they were riding an unstoppable wave. Just before the crunch, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was selling at a phenomenal 65 times dividends. Right back where it had been just before the dot-com bubble explosion. The market climbed to unrealistic heights, driven by unmitigated greed. Soon after the dollar's collapse, however, the stock market was driven by fear. Unlike in the previous crashes, this time the U.S. market slumped gradually. This was due to circuit breaker regulations on program trading implemented after the 1987 Wall Street slump. Instead of dropping precipitously in the course of one day as it had in 87, this time it took 19 days to drop 7,550 points. This made the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, and the 2008 stock market meltdown both look insignificant. The London and Tokyo markets were hit worse than the U.S. stock exchanges. The London market closed 5 days after the slump started. The Tokyo market, which was even more volatile, closed after only 3 days of record declines. Late in the second week of the stock market collapse, the domestic runs on U.S. banks began. The quiet international run on U.S. banks and the dollar had begun a month earlier. It took the citizenry in America that long to realize that the party was over. The only investors who made profits in the crunch were those who had invested in precious metals. Gold soared to $5,100 an ounce, with the other precious metals rising correspondingly. Even for these investors, their gains were only illusory paper profits. Anyone who was foolish enough to cash out of gold and into dollars after the run-up in prices would have soon lost everything. This was because the domestic value of the dollar collapsed completely just a few weeks later. The dollar collapsed because of the long-standing promises of the FDIC. All deposits insured to $100,000 they had pledged. When the domestic bank runs began, the government had to make good on its word. The only way that it could do this was to print money. Lots and lots of it. Since 1964, the currency had no backing with precious metals. Rumors suggested, and then news stories confirmed, that the government mints were converting some of their intaglio printing presses. Presses that had originally been designed to print $1 bills were converted to print $50 and $100 bills. This made the public suspicious. With overseas dollars being redeemed in large numbers, and with the printing presses running day and night turning out fiat currency, hyperinflation was inevitable. Inflation jumped from 16% to 35% in 3 days. From there on, it climbed in spurts during the next few days. 62%, 110%, 315%, and then to an incredible 2,100%. The currency collapse was reminiscent of what had happened in Zimbabwe. The value of the dollar began to be pegged hourly. It was the main topic of conversation. As the dollar withered in the blistering heat of hyperinflation, people rushed out to put their money into cars, furniture, appliances, tools, rare coins, anything tangible. This superheated the economy, creating a situation not unlike that in Germany's Weimar Republic in the 1920s. More and more paper was chasing less and less product. With a superheated economy, there was no way for the government to check the soaring inflation, aside from stopping the presses. This they could not do, however, because depositors were still flocking to the banks to withdraw all of their savings. The workers who still had jobs quickly caught on to the full implications of the mass inflation. They insisted on daily inflation indexing of their salaries, and in some cases even insisted on being paid daily. Citizens on fixed incomes were wiped out financially by the hyperinflation within 2 weeks. These included pensioners, those on unemployment insurance, and welfare recipients. Few could afford to buy a can of beans when it cost $150. The riots started soon after inflation bolted past the 1,000% mark. Detroit, New York City, and Los Angeles were the first cities to see full-scale rioting and looting. Soon the riots engulfed most other large cities, including Houston, San Antonio, Chicago, Phoenix, Philadelphia, San Jose, San Diego, Dallas, Indianapolis, and Memphis. It was when the Dow Jones average had slumped its first 1,900 points that Lars Lane decided to stock up. But by then, it was nearly too late. Gas cans had all been snapped up a week before. The shelves at the supermarkets were already being cleaned out. Unable to find extra batteries at department stores, Lars and Beth started looking elsewhere. They finally found some that had been overlooked at a Toys R Us store. They were able to find a few first aid supplies, but those too were being rapidly depleted, along with everything else at the local CVS drugstore. The local gun shops had been completely cleaned out of inventory. There wasn't a single gun or box of ammunition left for sale. At night, after the stores closed, Lars and Beth stayed up late, ordering things like batteries, light bulbs, Celox wound coagulant, mason jar lids, and gun cleaning equipment from internet vendors and from individual sellers on eBay. They placed multiple orders, realizing that in the scarcity of the new market paradigm, at least half of these orders would never arrive. To their dismay, they found that the internet ammunition vendors had completely run out of ammunition and extra magazines. After much searching, Lars did manage to order a spare firing pin, a spare extractor, and a few stripper clips for the pair of Finnish-made M39 Mosin-Nagant rifles that he and his brother had inherited from their father. As the local stores began to run out, there were fewer and fewer things that Lars and Lisbeth could buy. Beth suggested buying extra blue jeans and tube socks to trade, but they found that the clothing store shelves had already been decimated. Realizing that their money was rapidly becoming worthless, they resorted to buying motion sensor yard floodlights, plumbing parts, sheets of plywood, and 2x4 studs at the local building store, just as something that they could later barter. A week later, even those were unavailable. It was like a huge nationwide fire sale in progress. Everyone wanted out of dollars and into tangibles. But it soon became abundantly clear that there were too many dollars and too few useful tangibles available. Prices could only go one way. Up. The local banks were overwhelmed with cash withdrawals and soon got into the pattern of having their cash supply wiped out each morning and then renewed each night as local merchants made their deposits. Their transaction volume soared, but their deposit accounts quickly dwindled to below regulation levels. The queue of customers outside the bank each morning soon became the inspiration for jokes and jeering. "They have to print fresh money each night," became the standard joke. Lars was thankful that he had a 300-gallon above-ground tank of gasoline at the ranch and that it was nearly full when the economic crisis set in. He added a padlock to it, but he was worried that someone might try and steal the gas at gunpoint. Both in Bloomfield and the much larger city of Farmington, just a few miles west, many of the retail businesses that remained open were cleaned out, leaving the owners with piles of increasingly worthless greenbacks. Eventually, even the local gift store ran out of inventory. People have become so desperate to get rid of their dollars that they traded them for New Mexico logo T-shirts and coffee mugs made for the tourist trade. Chapter 3. The Crunch. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations will grow up around them, will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people, to whom it properly belongs. Thomas Jefferson, from the debate on the recharter of the bank bill, 1809. On Najaf, Iraq, 2 years before the crunch. Pain. That was his most vivid memory of the past 2 years. It had started with a fairly routine convoy of 5 up-armored Humvees in the old quarter of An Najaf. His last memory of that drive was of sitting in the sweltering back seat of the Humvee, looking down at a map and gripping a Sinkar's radio handset. Captain Lars Lane had been in liaison with his Afghanistan National Army, ANA, counterpart, discussing the planned locations of a couple of random checkpoints for the next day. The 50 gunner, standing above him, yelled, "Possible device, left!" A warning that he had spotted a suspicious object that might be an improvised explosive device. Then he saw a flash and heard a loud explosion. The next thing that Lars remembered was waking up in a field hospital, trying to focus his vision. And no sooner did he realize that he was in a hospital than he passed out again. He awoke again 28 hours later, more than 3,000 miles away, at Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, with his head throbbing. He asked, in an almost unintelligible voice, "Can you take the edge off this pain?" He vaguely remembered the face of the E6 male nurse who stood by his bedside. The nurse obliged with a fresh dose of Demerol IV via his Lurlock intravenous fluid connector. The nurse gave Lars some water on a sponge stick that looked like a lollipop. It was as Lars was getting these first dribbles of water that he realized that he had no vision in his left eye. Several hours later, he further realized that the vestiges of his left eye had been removed from its orbit and replaced by a nitrile rubber and gauze packing, supplemented with a drainage tube. Losing his eye put Lars into a brief depression, but then, seeing much more badly wounded soldiers around him, made him count his blessings. As he later told Beth, "At least I'm walking around on 2 good legs. Every day above ground is a gift from God." Lars gradually regained some awareness of his surroundings. A male nurse walked up to his bed and handed him a cup of water with a straw. The nurse held the cup while Lars took a couple of clumsy sips. Lars nodded and said, "Thanks. That's better." The nurse put the glass down within reach on Lane's bed table and said, "You were delirious. The first time I gave you water on a sponge stick, you tried to eat the sponge. Oh, and you kept repeating some phrases. I think they were Pashto or Arabic."
"Such as?"
"Two of them that I remember are Wayne Riff Attack and Urf Edak."
"What language was that?"
Lars thought for a moment and answered,
"That was Arabic. Wayne Rifakak means we are your friends, and Irfa Idak is an order. It means put your hands up."
"Kind of strange that you'd be using both of those in the same conversation," the nurse said, looking bemused.
"No, not where I've spent the last couple of years, up in Indian country. It happens all the time, believe me."
It was while at the Landstuhl Hospital that Lars was told the extent of his injuries. Most of his left hand had been amputated. His left arm was broken in 3 places, and he had 6 broken ribs. His left eye, left cheekbone, and 9 teeth were gone. There were multiple lacerations and second-degree burns to his face, neck, and arms. Days later, he was told that he also had a mild to moderate traumatic brain injury, TBI. It was much later that he learned that he had lost all hearing in his left ear and had a 60% hearing loss in his right ear. This news made Lane doubt whether he'd ever return to regular duty and pushed him into another bout of depression. After 4 days at Landstuhl, Lars was flown on a C-5 to Andrews Air Force Base and transferred to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. It was the most agonizing flight of his life. It seemed to last for days, and the pain was incredible. Lisbeth was there to meet him at Walter Reed. She and Grace stayed at the home of her cousin in Silver Spring, Maryland, for the next 5 months, visiting him almost every day. Lars spent 4 months at Walter Reed, where he got his reconstructive surgery and skin grafts. More pain. Then another month at a Walter Reed satellite hospital, getting his hearing aid and glass eye. It was there that he started doing more intense physical therapy. It was also while he was at Walter Reed that Lars was awarded a Purple Heart, pinned on his pillow by the vice president, who was there for a photo op. Lars caused quite a stir when the vice president asked him what he planned to do when he got out of the army and went home. Lars responded, "Home? If I may speak freely, sir, I intend to return to the big sandbox and take command of a civil affairs company. I'm not a quitter, unlike some people at the top of the chain of command. Your administration's accelerated drawdown is premature. It's putting both American soldiers and the citizenry of Afghanistan in peril. Now, sir, please leave my room before I say something rude about your boss." Just minutes after the vice president and his entourage left the hospital, Lars Lane was dressed down by the attending physician, an O-6, who very soon after placed a letter of reprimand in Lane's permanent 201 personnel file. Finally, he was transferred to Fort Sam Houston Hospital in Texas. That was where he got the rest of his dental work, his prosthetic hand, and an Army Commendation, ARCOM, medal. Lars jokingly called his spring-loaded prosthetic left hand Mr. President in homage to the movie Dr. Strangelove. He hated the hand. The hand had very few advantages. One was that it allowed him to do electrical work without fear of getting shocked. It also gave him the ability to pick up hot pots and pans from the kitchen stove without using a hot pad. But in almost all other respects, it was a hindrance and an annoyance. Hampered by the letter of reprimand, Lars was never approved to return to active duty without limitations. Then came a frustrating year of branch immaterial duty, pushing quartermaster paperwork at Fort Hood, spending as much time with the medac or oral surgeons and physical therapists as he did behind a desk. Lars held on for that last year to finish his dental work and to get his bump to major, the 04 pay grade, providing him with a more substantial disability retirement. His branch manager at PERSCOM confided that it was only because of some politicking of the promotion board by two of Lane's former brigade commanders that he was not passed over for promotion to 04. Once his promotion to major came through, Lane immediately resigned his commission. When he was discharged, Lars was 30 years old and an 04 over 6, a major with more than 6 years of service. He was also suffering from depression. His arm had healed well, and he was back to his normal exercise regimen of running 2 miles every 2 days with 200 sit-ups on the alternating days. Physically, aside from some nerve damage in his left arm, he was nearly as strong and limber as he had been before the ambush. But if it were not for his faith in God and the presence of his wife and his two young children, he had doubts that he would have ever recovered mentally. Chapter 4. Fujian, Tulu.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre,
the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart,